Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So my job is to pick up from where Father White left off and talk a little bit about types of grace. And Father White, I think, did a great job kind of setting us up for talking about this. I'm going to pick up with a couple things that he mentioned and expand on them just a little bit, and then try to move the ball a little further. This is an enormous subject, and we're talking about, in a way, like if we're going to do a retreat on grace or some talks on grace, what are we talking about? We're talking about something about God, as Father White pointed out, and also something about how we encounter God or are given a share in God's own life. You could even say in God's own nature. Now, that's a very audacious thing to say, but sacred scripture does, in fact, say that this is what God does for us. He gives us a share in the divine nature. Is it possible for a human creature to become God of the creature's nature? Absolutely not. Completely impossible. Beyond our capacity. And yet God wants us to have something of that. So this is what we're talking about. In a certain way, when we're talking about the subject of grace, then we're talking about the whole Christian mystery or the whole thing. So it's a difficult subject for that reason, because it touches absolutely everything, and it includes in a way absolutely everything. So you can, you know, it's like a sweater that is starting to fray, like you pull on one thread and pretty soon you're going to unravel the whole sweater. You have to be careful. So it's going to be maybe hard for us to wrap our arms around this subject just in this retreat, but we can at least try to get some perspectives on the issue, and also to see that this has been the subject of enormous theological investigation and also debate over the centuries. So there have been some real disagreements, and especially between Protestants and Catholics, some very significant disagreements about the theology of grace. So I'm going to try to like signpost some of those as we go along to try and understand where they come from. The first thing that I want to point out, though, when we're talking about this, is that many people coming from a contemporary perspective, but I mean, this has been true, I think, for several hundred years, going back even slightly before the Protestant Reformation, there has been a kind of psychological emphasis to this subject. And that's not necessarily the same emphasis that you find in Thomas Aquinas or in the Church Fathers, or for that matter, I think in St. Paul or in the Gospels. So this is a very important thing to become aware of. Okay, what do I mean by a psychological emphasis? We might, you know, if you say, oh, I'm going on a retreat about grace, and someone says, oh yeah, you know, I'd really like to learn more about grace, how God's grace works in my life. And you say, okay, what does that look like? You might say, well, you know, for example, now this is a real example from someone that I know. Her father had fallen gravely ill. He was actually in the hospital dying. And it happened all very suddenly, and it was very traumatic for the family. She goes to her father's bedside, and she's there with him, and she feels this very strong impulse to reach out to him and to say, do you believe that Jesus can heal you? And he said, yes. And in fact, he was miraculously healed, and he walked out of the hospital a little bit later. Okay, that's completely extraordinary. These things really do happen, and God can do that. Okay, so if you're talking about, all right, let's talk about that in the theology of grace. And you say, okay, well, this is an extraordinary experience of grace where she is sitting next to the bed, and all of a sudden this idea pops into her mind that she should say this to her father. It's not the kind of thing she would normally say to her father. And then she says it, and this extraordinary result happens. And then she wants to like reflect on that and be like, okay, well, that suggestion in her mind was a grace. Okay, yes, it is a grace. And sometimes we want to think about the life of grace always more or less in that kind of mode. It's like, I'm going to kind of think through my own interior spiritual experiences. And I'm going to look for those moments when I felt like God was noticeably doing something in my mind or in my heart or prompting me to do something that I wouldn't otherwise have done. And it seems kind of extraordinary and out of character for me, but I did it anyway. And people who have conversions often experience things like this. These are real experiences. Is that what the theology of grace is working with? Well, yes, those experiences are real. We want to have an account of them. Is that all the theology of grace is working with? No. Those are a kind of subset of what we want to work with. But grace is actually more than just those psychologically recognizable extraordinary moments. And if you have a theology of grace that is principally focused on the psychology of religious experience, then I think you're kind of biasing your theology of grace in a certain direction. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, the Church Fathers, and I think St. Paul himself have a more, what I would call, like metaphysical and theological account of grace. And that's what I think is actually a more powerful account of grace. So not placing the emphasis on trying to understand only our interior psychological experiences, but also understanding how God is acting in the whole of our life, even in our very ordinary experiences, where it does not immediately seem to me that God is moving me in some kind of extraordinary way. The Dominican worry, or the Thomist worry, with a theology of grace that focuses too much on the interior psychological extraordinary experiences, is that this makes it seem like God is an awful lot like maybe a friend who is whispering in my ear. Or, you know, I don't know if you watch the old cartoons where, you know, like you have an angel, like Donald Duck is an angel and Donald Duck is a devil, you know, like whispering in somebody's ear. And then you begin to think that God working, like in giving grace, is working like other kinds of creatures can act on me, like whispering in my ear, the way an angel might give me a suggestion, or the way a friend who's tempting or helping me in virtue. But in fact, the Thomistic account, and I think the classical account, wants to see that God is a deeper kind of cause than that. He's a cause of our very being. And so God can work within the creature in a way unlike any other creature can. And in fact, we want to say that your existence is caused by God, and all of your actions are caused by God, including your free actions. Okay, now you might be saying, whoa, okay, now this is presenting a major question. Can a human being's free act be also caused by God and remain free? That's one of the capital questions that you confront in the theology of grace. And the classical answer, and it's not just Thomas Aquinas' answer, but it's the answer of sacred scripture. It's the answer of St. Augustine. It's the answer of many of the church fathers in the church's great tradition. The answer is yes, we have to say that. We can't even have an account of God's providence, his providential governance of the world, if we can't see how God could be acting in human, free human creatures and also free angels in order to bring about his plan. And a lot of the church's spirituality also presupposes this. When we pray for another person, that person would convert. What are we asking for? Are we asking just that God would like whisper louder and louder in the ear and hope that the person eventually like listens to it? Or is there something else going on? The difficulty for us is that if there's something else going on and we have a deeper account of how God is not only the cause of these extraordinary moments, but how he can work within the whole of our lives, this requires us also to grapple with deeper understandings of what is the human will, what is good for human beings, like how do we act towards a good, and what are we talking about when we're talking about human freedom? So that's one of the reasons why this subject of grace is important and also can be difficult and can require some philosophical rigor too. But I think it's really interesting and it's really fun to talk about. So I hope we'll have a fun time talking about it. I'm not trying to intimidate you about the subject, but just to like wake you up to the fact that this is a rich and complex and really interesting subject. Where do my desires come from? Well, it seems that they emerge naturally from my being the kind of person that I am, the kind of creature that I am. Human beings have pretty predictable desires in a lot of categories. But then certain people may have rather unique desires. You know, we see one person beginning to really desire to know God more. And another person, you know, maybe you've been sitting in your Civ class. I'm talking to the Providence College students. I taught Civ, you know. I know what it's like, at least from the teacher's perspective. You got a whole bunch of students sitting there, and one of them begins to think like, wow, that's really deep. I want to think about that more. Maybe I want to go to the chapel and pray about that. There's like a new desire that has been awakened in that student. And the student seated next to her is like not thinking that. And is thinking of something else. Like what else? Okay, well, let's not investigate that. Less interesting for our purposes. But have you had this experience? I mean, I'm betting that most of you are here because you are a student who at some point found yourself sitting there and discovering that a new desire had been awakened in you. Okay, is that desire just from you? Is it a free act on your part to begin to desire that? Where did that desire come from? This is what we're trying to get at when we're talking about the mystery of grace. And if you have too strong a psychological experience kind of approach, you might think that God is only ever like whispering in your ear, and then it's entirely you who respond. Now, we want to say that it's you who respond. But could it be that God is also causing your response? And he's causing your response to be free. He's awakening something in you that every human being, in some sense, is capable of doing, loving God, but that our nature doesn't just automatically do. And especially our nature as affected by sin, which Father White talked about yesterday. Okay, so that's really what we're trying to get at. Okay, Father White mentioned types of grace or senses of the word grace. The Thomistic account of grace is a little more intellectually demanding, and you might even say austere, than an account that is just focused on psychological experiences. Because while it wants to account for those psychological experiences, it wants to see how God could be working even on a deeper level. So God certainly can work in our thoughts, our imagination, our emotions, but he doesn't always work on them. Sometimes they don't seem to be doing much. And maybe the most important way that God works is somehow on a deeper level. So Thomas Aquinas says, you cannot detect grace by examining your spiritual psychology. Sometimes you will have spiritual experiences and they will be from God. Sometimes you could have spiritual experiences and they are not from God. They could be from a demon. They could also be from mental illness. They could just be from the fact that you ate too much roast beef, which is what Ebenezer Scrooge thinks, right? You remember that line at the beginning of A Christmas Carol? When I was younger, I thought, well, that's a really weird thing. Now that I'm older, if I eat roast beef, I can have weird dreams, you know, because my body just doesn't digest beef as efficiently as it did when I was in my 20s. So it's possible for roast beef to cause some kind of, okay, maybe something that I could confuse with us. Okay, so the point is, you cannot detect grace that way. Those experiences are not infallible, reliable indicators of grace. And what Aquinas and the classical tradition is trying to do with the theology of grace is give a deeper metaphysical account. So we have to be able to use some philosophical ideas, and that's why it's a little more austere. But I think it's much more powerful when you get to the bottom of it. Okay. Senses of the word grace. Father White elaborated on this a bit. I just want to say a few more words. And here we could actually look at a text of Aquinas, so I want to do justice to the fact that you have these texts. Do you guys have the text with you? This is in question 110, article 1, so on page 10. I just want you to see that, like, I'm not making all this up. This is actually in Aquinas. I think it's fun to read Aquinas directly and see some of this. Aquinas is asking whether grace implies anything in the soul. So let's look at his answer. I answer that. It's on page 10. According to the common manner of speech, grace is usually taken in three ways. First, for anyone's love. As we are accustomed to say that the soldier is in the good graces of the king. That is, the king looks at him with favor. Secondly, it is taken for any gift freely bestowed. As we are accustomed to say, I do you this act of grace. Thirdly, it is taken for the recompense of a gift given gratis or freely, inasmuch as we are said to be grateful for benefits. So let's just understand those three senses. The first sense is that someone is being gracious to another. And that means, like, the disposition of the giver to give something freely to another. So the king is gracious to the soldier, meaning the king didn't owe it to the soldier, but freely, out of kind of benevolence or love that wasn't owed, gave something to the soldier. So we can talk about the grace of the king. And we have this phrase of, like, being in his good graces, right? That's what it's really referring to. Then you can talk about what the king gave to the soldier. You know, the soldier could say, I received the grace from the king to be named the number one general or something like that. I received that as a grace from him. And then the soldier can be grateful to the king. Now, in English, we say grateful, and that is related to the word grace. In Romance languages, like Spanish, how do you say thank you? Gracias. Okay. In French, merci. Okay. Mercy. It's related. In Italian, grazie. Okay. So the Romance languages, and in Latin, which is what their root is, it's gratias tibi ago. I give grace to you, which is I give thanks to you. So there's these three senses of grace. Okay. What does this have to do with our subject? Well, obviously a lot. Let's go back to the text of Aquinas. Of these three, the second, that's the gift received, depends on the first, the love of the king or the good disposition of the king. since one bestows something on another gratis from the love wherewith he receives him into his good graces. And from the second proceeds the third, since from benefits bestowed gratis or freely arises gratitude. Okay, so what do we have here? We discover that there are different ways to speak about grace, and the most primary among them is with respect to God himself. That God loves us is the foundation for all grace. And then that we receive something good from God flows from that primary sense of the love of the giver. So in the domain of grace, the dominating principle is the love of God. And in a certain way, we can reduce the entire theology of grace back to God's love. Now, this is really interesting and important and spiritually profound. Why does God love us? Why does he love you? He does not love you because you are good. He does not love you because he is getting something from you. He loves you because he is good. He loves you because he is infinitely good. So his love for you does not actually depend on you at all. It depends on him. And the fact that he gives you good things is not because you deserve them. It is just because he loves you, because he is good. Now you might say, well, I would kind of like to be good enough to deserve some of that. And okay, I can understand that. I mean, I think we can all kind of understand that desire. But in a way, it's much better to have it set up this way. Why? Because sometimes you are not good. And then God still loves you. So his love does not depend on you being good. Rather, his love is the reason that you are good. So he, by bestowing gifts on you, makes you good. So the cause of grace is, first of all, God, God's love for you, his love for sinners. And then we look at the gift that sinners receive, which makes them good. But if you see it this way, now you've already made a very significant step in the right direction, because now you see how grace cannot be owed to the creature. The whole basis for grace is that it's coming gratuitously from God by a completely free gift. But grace can change the creature by making the creature good. And in fact, it does. So and this is a key distinction between Catholic and Protestant theologies. In Catholic theology, it has really always been the position that God's love has real effects in the creature to make the creature good. Whereas some Protestant positions hold that God just to say that God is gracious towards you is just God affixing a new label to you while you don't actually change. Okay, that's not the Catholic position, and we're going to be talking here principally about the Catholic position. Okay, from there, I want to talk about a little bit of the types of grace. Okay, so this is what we're aiming at. One type of grace is to just talk about God's love. But for the most part, we want to talk about the effects of grace in us. And that's where the different terminology of the types of grace come from. And there's a couple major divisions in the types of grace. And let me just maybe write down a couple things here. You have sanctifying grace, also called habitual grace. It's a habitus, or a stable disposition of soul. We have what are called charismatic graces. These are graces that don't sanctify the person who receives them, but are for the sake of some work of the Spirit. So charisma comes from spiritual gifts, charismatic graces. would be referring to, for example, like a grace of prophecy or of preaching or of healing. So my friend who prayed over her father and he was healed, this is really talking about a charismatic grace. Then we have, and it doesn't quite map onto this to this level, but another type of grace that we want to talk about, actual graces. So some charismatic graces will be actual, some will be habitual. So this maybe I should have written habitual over here, because these are in some ways overlapping categories in certain respects. So actual graces are different from habitual graces. Sanctifying graces are different from charismatic graces, but some sanctifying graces, we can talk about, usually we talk about sanctifying grace as being habitual. We can also refer to some actual graces that are sanctifying, certainly actual graces that are charismatic. Okay, so I want to just identify some of these divisions. In question 111 of the Summa, where Aquinas talks about the types of grace, he identifies this distinction, sanctifying and charismatic. He doesn't have an article that talks about actual versus habitual, but he does use that division in that question. So I want to talk about both those. And we could also talk about other divisions, but they're not as important, so I'm going to just kind of put them on the side here, and we can get to them if we have time. If you read the text, you will have seen there's a distinction between operating and cooperating. That's actually, yeah, historically very important, but it's a little confusing, and I think it's maybe better to kind of leave that to the side rather than trying to get into the depths of that. But we can talk about that if you like. Aquinas inherits the operating-cooperating distinction from St. Augustine. Then there's prevenient and subsequent, and that's also a traditional category that Aquinas inherits. So this is actually pretty easy to explain. Let me just explain it very briefly. One grace can be prevenient. That means to come before. That's basically just the Latin word for coming before. And subsequent, to come after. So you can talk about one grace coming before another and therefore being prevenient to some further thing. So an example might be, I went to CIV and I was listening to the lecture and something moved me interiorly to think about God, to love God for the first time, really. And we'd say, okay, that's like grace number one. And then after class, I went to the chapel and knelt down to pray and felt loved by God. We could say, okay, grace number two. And then from there, I resolved, you know, I am going to go talk to Father Justin about becoming Catholic, and eventually receives baptism at the Easter Vigil. Okay, grace number three. Now, maybe there are lots of other graces in that story. We have at least three there. Okay, so number one is prevenient with respect to number two and number three. Number two is subsequent to number one, and number three is subsequent to one and two. Two is subsequent to one, but prevenient for three. Okay, it's no more complicated than that. All Aquinas is identifying is that grace is not just like one little atomistic moment. It's set in the context of a whole trajectory of your life, and there can be an order to them, because God is not just like zapping in one totally discrete moment. Your life makes sense as a whole in God's mind, and he has a plan for you, and he's moving you on a trajectory towards himself. That's the whole idea behind the theology of grace, is that God has a plan. He has a plan, in fact, for the entire world. And you're a part of it. You're a uniquely loved part of it. And so God's going to try to work in your life over time to put you on a trajectory back to him. Okay. So divisions of grace. I want to talk a little bit about actual graces and habitual graces and try to understand, like, why do we need them? why do we need these two categories? These are two major capital categories. Try to understand a little bit about that. Okay, we've talked about God's love as the cause of our goodness. God's love is absolutely first in the order of grace. What do we desire? What do we love? What is our will doing? The theology of grace often focuses on what our will is doing. And so it requires some philosophical, some extra philosophical discussion here to understand what Aquinas thinks our will is and what it's doing. So this is a very super quick summary. We could talk a lot more about it if you like. Aquinas is not a modern in thinking that the primary act of the will is to like choose between contraries. On this model, maybe, you know, the modern model, it's like walking into a restaurant, you know, you're at Denny's and you're like, well, I could opt for the Grand Slam. I could opt for pancakes, or I could opt for waffles, or I could opt for the omelet. I could opt for bacon, or I could opt for sausage. And, you know, you just have like these things which are basically, you know, just menu choices. And why do you choose one versus another? Well, it's just, I just felt like it. That's just what I chose. There's not really a deeper meaning or a deeper answer to that question, why you chose one versus another. For Aquinas, the will is actually, you know, more robust a faculty than that. It's not just opting or choosing between contraries. It is the faculty of desiring with your mind. Okay, so we have the experience of desiring with our bodies, and we're familiar with bodily desires. The most basic is like, you know, when you're thirsty, your body wants water. And you learn what that is. When you're hungry, your body wants food. So we have bodily desires. You know, when you're really cold, your body wants warmth. Can your mind want something? And Aquinas thinks the answer is yes. Rational creatures have desires with their mind. What would be a good example of a rational desire where we can contrast it with a bodily desire? Well, suppose you're sick. Maybe you get a cancer diagnosis. And the medicine that the doctor is going to give you, he says, okay, if you don't take this medicine, you're going to die in 3 months. If you take this medicine, you're going to feel really terrible. Your hair is going to fall out. You're going to be nauseous, but it's going to kill the cancer and you can live a normal life until, you know, a natural ripe old age. When people confront that kind of situation, they really want that medicine, even though their body, in a sense, doesn't want it, right? They take the pills, it makes them feel really sick. But some people with cancer will go to great lengths to get those pills. Like if their insurance doesn't cover it, for example, they'll start writing letters and, okay, this is not a bodily desire because it makes them feel wretched. Why do they want it? Because their mind recognizes that it is good for them. So the mind can recognize something that the body doesn't recognize, like, oh, I have cancer. I am going to die. I don't feel the cancer right now, but I have to act to save my life. This is a rational desire. Okay, this is what the will is doing. Okay, so the rational desire of the will depends on your mind's ability to recognize something as good. All right, what is that? What is a good? Now, here too, moderns make, I think, a mistake. They will say, oh, good is what obeys the law, and bad is what violates the law, something like that. Okay, is good or bad determined just by some law decreed by God? The classical account, the account of Augustine and of the Church Fathers and of Thomas Aquinas, is not like this at all. Good is not just positing a value that someone above is dictating. Rather, good is about what perfects me, what makes me whole and healthy and flourishing. So if good is actually what perfects me, then you immediately begin to understand why we always desire what we perceive with our minds to be good. So that's what the sick person is perceiving in the chemotherapy. It makes me feel sick, but it is perfecting me, given that I have this cancer. So if you see that, then you see that good also is related to the kind of being that you are. So what is good for a human being is different from what is good for a sculpture of a human being. You know, the Michelangelo's sculpture of David has a human shape. But what is good for that sculpture might be, you know, cleaning it rigorously with like this chemical solution to prevent mold from growing on it. But that would not be good as a skin lotion, right? So it's not good for me to be cleaned with that, even though it's good for that statue to be. Okay, so what's good for one kind of being is not good for another kind of being. Likewise, what's good for a dog is not necessarily what's good for a human being. Now, it's good for a dog to have food and warmth. It's good for a human being to have food and warmth, but human beings have a higher nature than dogs. So we need to distinguish what is good for, what's perfective of a dog as a dog and what's perfective of a human being as a human being. So Aquinas also would say, goodness is related to being. In fact, goodness and being are really the same, but only differ in idea. Like goodness refers to the completion of the being under the aspect of being desirable. Okay, this is just super, super fast, like metaphysical background to the theology of grace. You might be wondering, why am I talking about it? Because what I want to get at is that God will help us to desire by his grace things that our nature would not naturally aim at. But this is one of the most important things that grace does for us. And very importantly, we exist in a fallen state, as Father White explained, which means sometimes our wills are stuck, directed towards things that are not really good for us. And that's another function of grace, is to detach us from those unfitting things and reorient us towards what is really supremely good, and therefore what is really perfective of us. And this is where habitual grace comes into the picture. So we may need the help of some new dispositions of soul in order to desire what is supernaturally good for us. Here's an example. If you are like me, you know, a middle-aged man who is not in shape, and you say, hey, Father, let's go run a marathon today. That doesn't sound attractive to me at all. Now, an earlier version of me liked jogging until I had some injuries. And going out for a long run on a Saturday sounded great. Do any of you have this experience? Like maybe not being in shape and then getting in shape. And now like actually what previously was not very pleasant becomes pleasant or even something you look forward to doing. You know, the training is actually kind of fun. That involves acquiring a new habit, you might say. It's not yet a spiritual habit or a virtue, but getting in shape is a little bit like that. You acquire a new capacity and it shapes your desires. And if we presuppose that, like, distance running is good for you, which maybe is debatable, but if we presuppose that that's good for you and it's a kind of perfection of you, then we would say, like, acquiring that habit of distance running is like opening up a new zone of human perfection to you. We could take another example. This would be like learning to play a musical instrument, playing the piano, Father White playing the banjo. I remember when Father White couldn't play the banjo. Now he can. He can play quite well. If you get a video of somebody like, well, let me just use the piano because I've done that and I've experienced my own unique form of frustration. And maybe you've had this. How many have studied the piano? So a number of you have. If you've ever like listened to a beautiful, complex piano piece, maybe it's a piece of Bach or Beethoven being played even quickly, in a virtuoso way. You're like, wow, that is so awesome. I would love to be able to do that. I get the music for it. I sit down at the piano bench. I start like trying to play it and I realize, oh, I cannot play this at all. And it becomes very frustrating. Like maybe you work on it for a long time. And I mean, I'm already starting to sweat just thinking about that experience because like I would find myself so frustrated at the piano trying to play this beautiful piece and I just can't do it. The amazing thing is that with training and a lot of apprenticeship and practice, you actually can acquire that capacity to where it becomes not only possible for you to play the music, but to play it well, to play it without a lot of effort, to play it without any of that frustration. A kind of new zone of human activity opens up for you, and you begin to desire sitting down and practicing that in a way that when you were just a beginner, like sitting down and practicing the piano might have been really painful to you. Why talk about this in the order of grace? Because you've had the experience, perhaps, sitting in your civ class or another class where, like, previously life with God wasn't something that sounded very desirable to you. And then somehow God begins awakening in you a desire for it. You begin to recognize that it's a real good. It's a good that you need God to achieve. You can't get there on your own. And when you begin to taste that, and I mean, taste maybe isn't the right analogy quite, because that's a bodily thing. We're really talking about your mind. It's like your mind is waking up to the reality of God. And you begin to realize how good he is. This is God giving you, suppose he really gives you the stable capacity to know him by faith, to trust in him by hope, and to love him above all things by charity. We're talking about sanctifying grace, or a habitual disposition of soul by which you have a new capacity for knowing and loving. And that new capacity opens up a new zone for your life. This is a very important category of grace. We need this habitual sanctifying grace as the basis for beginning to really live out a Christian life. Okay, last category that I want to talk about, and that's actual graces. Actual graces refer to punctual gifts of God. And actual, you might say, well, actual, that's kind of a strange name. It comes from the Latin term for act, actus. Our word actual refers to something that really is there in act versus in potency. Does that distinction make sense to you? We could talk about, like, right now, you are potentially praying in the chapel, but you're not actually praying in the chapel. That's the distinction between act and potency. You are potentially doing it, but you're not actually doing it. Later today, you will go to the chapel and pray, and then you will be actually praying in the chapel. So act and potency. An actual grace is a grace by which God makes you actually love him, makes you actually know him. Now I'm saying makes. And that is a limitation of our own language. Because what I don't want to suggest is that God is like pushing you in a way that compromises your freedom, but rather that because God is the author of our very being, he's able to awaken your own rational desire, that is your own will, to do its thing, which is to love what is good. And when he awakens you, when he activates you, you are doing it. And that you are doing it is really your act, your free act, and also has God as its ultimate, deepest metaphysical source. So let's go back to the point that I started this talk with about the difference between a psychological approach and a metaphysical theological approach. Once you begin to talk about this subject of actual grace, you begin to understand why it's important to have a metaphysical approach. Because even when it seems to you like you're just engaging in your normal business of life, God is standing, you might say, within you or beneath all of your actions, giving them the very actuality by which you do what you do. And in his most interior way of acting, it's possible for him to shape your acts so that you freely begin to do what leads you to him in a supernatural way. And that's marvelous and beautiful. And it's very important, I think, for the theology of grace to see that God can be the source of our very freedom. Okay, I'm going to conclude with just one final point, which is the question that very often arises, and we'll have plenty more time to talk about this later in the weekend, about whether these acts are really free, if God is moving you or activating you to do them. And here I just want to point out something that I hope, an experience that I hope that you've had. Have you ever had the experience of knowing that you ought to do something, but only half wanting to do it? So maybe you know, like, I think I probably should become Catholic, or I think I probably should start taking my faith more seriously. But I know if I do that, I have to give up this. I'll let you fill in the blank for this, because this is incompatible with living this life. And a part of me really wants to hang on to this. I'm not ready to give it up yet. And yet I know that in order to live the life that I know that I should, I'm going to have to give it up. Okay, you see the point? Your heart is divided. You're loving two things. Those two things are incompatible with each other. And when you have that experience, which I think is very common for any sinner, and we all are sinners, to have that experience is to feel unfree. I know I should get baptized, but I'm not sure that I can, because I'm not sure I can let go of that. Now, the experience of a conversion sometimes brings with it the ability to finally let go of this thing that is holding me back, this thing that I know I shouldn't love, but somehow I still do. And when you are freed from that love of what is lower and unworthy of you, so that you can really love God with your whole heart, you don't experience that as God forcing you to do something. You experience that as God setting you free of what was chaining your will. And that's because our will can get stuck on things that are lower. But our will is made for what is higher. When God breaks our attachment to what is lower so that we can really love with an undivided heart what is higher, we experience it as setting us free. And that's the experience of grace, elevating and freeing us for the love of God. So that's why Aquinas would say, yeah, when God moves you, he's actually setting you free. And then you really feel free. Okay, that's the last point I wanted to make. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org /donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.